sinking into a half moon on my throat and stinging like a thousand needles, like a swarm of bees. I heard hoofbeats, and then felt the cold air on the back of my neck, felt the absence of pressure and pain. Like a great winged bird, something swooped down from above and called my name. That was the last thing I remembered, because when I opened my eyes, I was in Damien's arms, and he was carrying me home. The door opened, and Alex stood inside. "What happened?" he asked, his eyes flying to mine. "She was attacked," Damien answered. "She needs a surgeon." "She needs me," Alex said, and he took me from Damien's arms into his own. I cried out as I was jostled between them, as Alex slammed the door closed with his boot. He carried me into my bedroom. As he lay me down, I saw all the blood on his shirt, and my head began to swim. "Shh," he soothed, turning my head so that he could see the wound. I thought he was going to faint.
"Is it bad?"
"No," he said, but I knew he was lying. "I just can't bear the sight of blood." He left me for a few minutes, promising to return, and when he did, he had a bowl of warm water, a cloth, and a bottle of whiskey. The last he held up to my lips. "Drink," he commanded, and I tried, but found myself coughing violently. "More," he said. Eventually, when the fire in my throat had turned into a glow in my belly, he began to wash my neck and then spilled whiskey over the open gash. I nearly came out of my skin. "Let go," he said. "It will be better that way." I didn't understand what he meant until I saw him threading the needle and realized what he was going to do. As he pierced the skin in the hollow of my throat, I blacked out. It was late in the afternoon when I awakened again. Alex sat in the chair beside my bed, his hands steepled before him as if in prayer. When he saw me stirring, a visible relief washed over his features. His hand on my forehead was warm. He stroked my cheek, my hair. "If you wanted my attention," Alex said, "all you had to do was ask."
Joseph. My brother used to beg for a dog when we were little. Our neighbors had one, some sort of retriever, and he would spend hours in the yard teaching it to roll over, to sit, to speak. But my father was bothered by pet dander, and because of this, I knew that no matter how hard Franz pleaded, he wasn't going to get his wish. One autumn night, when I was maybe 10 years old and asleep in the room I shared with Franz, I heard whispering. I woke to find my brother sitting up in bed, with a small hunk of cheese on the covers between his legs. Nibbling on the cheese was a tiny field mouse, and as I watched, my brother stroked the fur on its back. Now, mind you, my mother did not keep the kind of house that attracts vermin. She was always scrubbing the floor, or dusting, or what have you. The next day, I found my mother stripping the sheets off our beds, even though it was not laundry day. "Those filthy, dirty mice, as soon as it gets cold outside, they try to find a way in. I found droppings," she told me, shuddering. "Tomorrow, on your way home from school, you will buy some traps." I thought of Franz. "You want to kill them?" My mother looked at me strangely. "What else should we do with pests?" That night, before we went to sleep, Franz took another sliver of cheese he had stolen from the kitchen and put it down beside him on the bed. "I'm going to name him Ernst," Franz told me. "How do you know he's not an Erma?" But Franz didn't answer, and before long he was asleep. On the other hand, I stayed awake. I listened carefully till I heard the scratch of tiny claws on the wood floor, and watched in the moonlight as the mouse scrambled up the blanket to get the cheese Franz had left. Before it could succeed, however, I grabbed the mouse and smacked it against the wall in one quick motion. The noise woke up Franz, who started crying when he saw his pet dead on the floor. I am sure the mouse didn't feel anything. After all, it was only a mouse. Plus, my mother had made it very clear what should be done with such a creature. I was just doing what she would have, eventually. I was only following orders. I don't know if I can explain how it felt to suddenly be the golden child. It is true my parents didn't have much to say about Hitler and the politics of Germany, but they were proud when Herr Sollenmach held me up as a benchmark for all other boys in our little Kameradschaft. They didn't complain about my marks as much, because instead I would come home every weekend with winner's ribbons and praise from Herr Sollenmach. To be honest, I do not know if my parents believed in the Nazi philosophy. My father could not have fought for Germany even if he wanted. He had a gammy leg from a sledding injury when he was a child. And if my parents had their doubts about Hitler's vision for Germany, they appreciated his optimism and the hope that our country could regain its greatness. Still, having me as Herr Sollenmach's favorite did nothing but help their status in the community. They were the fine Germans who had produced a boy like me. No nosy neighbor was going to comment on the fact that my father had not enlisted, not with me as the star representative of the local HJ. Every Friday night, I ate dinner at Herr Sollenmach's house. I brought flowers for his daughter, and one summer evening, when I was 16, I lost my virginity to her on an old horse blanket in a cornfield. Herr Sollenmach took to calling me Son, as if I were already a member of his family. And shortly before my 17th birthday, he recommended me for the HJ Streifendienst. These were patrol force units within the Hitlerjugend. Our job was to keep order at meetings, to report disloyalty, and to denounce anyone who spoke ill of Hitler, even in some cases our own parents. I had heard of a boy, Walter Hess, who turned his own father into the Gestapo. It is funny, the Nazis did not like religion, but that is the closest analogy I can use to describe the indoctrination we had as children. Organized religion, to the Third Reich, was in direct competition with serving Germany. For who could pledge an equal allegiance to both the Führer and God? Instead of celebrating Christmas, for example, they celebrated the winter solstice. However, no child really chooses his religion. It is just the luck of the draw which blanket of beliefs you are wrapped in. When you are too young to think for yourself, you are baptized and taken to church and droned at by a priest and told that Jesus died for your sins. And since your parents nod and say this is true, why should you not believe them? Much the same was the message we were given by Herr Sollenmach and the others who taught us. What is bad is harmful, we were told. What is good is useful. It truly was that simple. When our teachers would put a caricature of a Jew on the board for us to see, pointing at such traits that were associated with inferior species, we trusted them. They were our elders. Surely they knew best. Which child does not want his country to be the best, the biggest, the strongest in the world? One day Herr Sollenmach took our Kameradschaft on a special trip. Instead of marching out of town, like we did on many of our hikes, Herr Sollenmach walked us up the short road that led to Wewelsburg Castle, the one that Heinrich Himmler himself had requisitioned for SS ceremonial headquarters. We all knew the castle, of course. We'd grown up with it. Its three towers shielded a triangular courtyard, perched high on a rock above the Alma Valley. It was part of our local history lessons. But none of us had been inside since the SS began its reconstruction. Now it was no longer a place to play football in the courtyard. It was for the elite. "Who can tell me why this castle is so important?" Herr Sollenmach asked as we trudged up the hill. My brother, the scholar, answered first. It's got historic relevance since it's near the site of an earlier German victory, where Hermann der Cherusker defeated the Romans in AD 9. The other boys snickered. Unlike in gymnasium, Franz wasn't going to get any points for knowing his history textbook here. But why is it important to us? Herr Sollenmach demanded. A boy named Lucas, who was a member of the HJ Streifendienst, like me, raised his hand. It now belongs to the Reichsführer SS, he said. Himmler, who as chief of the SS had taken over the German police and the concentration camps, had visited the castle in 1933, and had leased it that same day for 100 years, planning to restore it for the SS. In 1938, the North Tower was still under construction. We could see this as we approached. Himmler says the Obergruppenführersaal will be the center of the world after the final victory, Herr Sollenmark announced. He has deepened the moats already and is trying to spruce up the interior. Rumor has it he will be here today to check on its progress. Do you hear that, boys? The Reichsführer SS himself, right in Wewelsburg. I did not see how Herr Sollenmark would gain entrance to the castle, since it was guarded, and not even the leader of the local Kameradschaft was in the habit of mingling with the highest echelon of officers in the National Socialist Party. But as we approached, Herr Sollenmark hailed, and the guard hailed back. Werner, Herr Sollenmark said. Quite an exciting day, no? You're right on time, the soldier said. Tell me, how is Mary and the girls? I should have realized that Herr Sollenmark would leave nothing to chance. My brother pulled me by the arm to draw my attention to the man in the center of the courtyard, addressing a clot of officers. Blood tells, the man said. The laws of Aryan selection favor those who are stronger, smarter, and more righteous in character than their inferior counterparts. Loyalty, obedience, truth, duty, comradeship. These are the cornerstones of the knighthood of old and the future of the Schutzstaffel. I did not understand what he was saying, really, but I knew him from the respect he was getting from the crowd that this must be Himmler himself. Yet this slight, stuffy man looked more like a bank teller than the head of the German police. Then I realized he was pointing at me. You, boy, he said, and he gestured. I stepped forward and saluted the way we had been taught at our HJ meetings. You're from around here? Yes, Reichsführer, I said. I am a member of the HJ Streifendienst. So tell me, boy, why would a country looking toward racial purity and the future of a new world choose a decrepit castle as a training center? This was a trick question. Clearly a man as important as Himmler would not have made a mistake in choosing a place like Wewelsburg. My mouth went dry. My brother, standing beside me, coughed. Hartmann, he whispered. I didn't know what he was trying to say by speaking our last name. Maybe he thought I should introduce myself. That way Himmler would know exactly who was the idiot standing in front of him. Then I realized my brother had not said Hartmann. He'd said Hermann. Because, I replied, it's not a decrepit castle. Himmler smiled slowly. Go on. It is the place Hermann de Cherusker fought the Romans and won. So even though other cultures wound up becoming part of the Roman Empire, the German identity stayed intact, just like we will again now, when we win the war. Himmler narrowed his eyes. What is your name, boy? Kameradschaftführer Hartmann, I said. He walked through the crowd and put his hand on my shoulder. A warrior, a scholar, and a leader, all in one. This is the future of Germany. As the crowd erupted in cheers, he pushed me forward. You will come with me, Himmler said. He led me down a set of stairs toward Die Gruft, the vault. In the basement of the towers that was still under construction was a round room. At its center, buried in the floor, was a gas pipe. Around the edges of the room were 12 niches, each with its own pedestal. This is where it will all end, Himmler said, his voice hollow in the small chamber. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Reichsführer? This is where I will be, long after the final victory. This will be the final resting place of the top 12 SS generals. He turned to me. Perhaps there is time for a bright young man like you to reach that potential. It was at that moment I decided to enlist. As proud as Herr Sollenmark was about my enlistment as an SS Sturmmann, my mother was equally devastated. She was worried for me as the war escalated. But she was equally worried for my brother, who at 17 still lived with his head in a book, and who would be losing the protection I provided. She and my father held a little social gathering on the eve before I was to report to the concentration camp Sachsenhausen, as part of the SS Totenkopfverbände, the Death Head Unit. Our friends and neighbors came. One of them, Herr Schäft, who worked for the local newspaper, took a photograph of me blowing out the candles on the chocolate cake my mother made. You can see it here. I still have the clipping she mailed me afterward. I've looked at that picture often. You see how happy I am in it? Not just because I am holding my fork over the plate, waiting to eat something delicious. Not just because I was drinking beer like a man instead of a boy. Because everything is still possible for me. It is the last photograph I have of myself where my eyes aren't full of knowledge, of understanding. One of my father's friends began to sing to me, Hoch soll leben, hoch soll leben, dreimal hoch. Long may he live, three cheers. Suddenly the door burst open, and my friend Lucas's little brother ran in, wild and quivering with excitement. Herr Solenmark says we must come right away, he said, and we shouldn't wear our uniforms. Now, this was curious. We always wore our uniforms with great pride, and my mother was not terribly inclined to let us out at midnight. But the other members of the HJ, including Franz, and I followed. We ran to the community center, where we held our meetings, and found Herr Solenmark dressed, like us, in street clothes. Parked in front was a truck, the kind used by the military, with an open back and benches for us to sit on. They piled in, and from the snippets of information I received from other boys, learned that some German official named Vom Rath had been assassinated by a Polish Jew, that the Führer himself had said spontaneous retaliations by the German people would not be stopped. By the time the truck pulled up in Paderborn, just a few miles away from Wevelsburg, the streets were filled with people armed with sledgehammers and axes. This is where Arthur lives, Franz murmured to me, speaking of his former friend from school. This didn't surprise me. The last time I'd been to Paderborn was a year ago, when my father had gone to buy my mother a fancy pair of leather boots for Christmas, handmade by a Jewish cobbler. We were given instructions. 1. Do not endanger non-Jewish German life or property. 2. Do not loot the Jewish businesses or homes. Just destroy them. 3. Foreigners, even Jewish ones, were not to be the subjects of violence. Herr Solenmark pressed a heavy shovel into my hand. Go, Rainer, he said. Show these swine the punishment they deserve. There were torches, the only way we could see in the dark of night. The air was filled with screams and smoke. The sound of shattering glass was a constant rain, and the shards crunched beneath our boots as we ran through the town, yelling at the tops of our lungs and smashing the storefront windows. We were wild boys, frenzied, our sweat and our fear drying on our skin. Even Franz, who did not strike a single business storefront that I saw, was running with his cheeks flushed and his hair matted down with perspiration, caught in the vortex of a mob mentality. It was strange, being told to cause destruction. We were good German boys, who behaved well, and who were reprimanded by our mothers for breaking a lamp or a china teacup. We had grown up poor enough to recognize the value of one's belongings. Yet this world, full of fire and mayhem, was the final proof that we had fallen through Alice's looking-glass. Nothing was as it had been. Nothing was as it seemed to be. The proof lay broken and glittering at our feet. Finally, we reached the store I had visited with my father, the cobbler's tiny shop. I leaped up and grabbed the bottom of his swinging sign, yanking it from its moorings so that it hung drunkenly by a single chain. I hurled the bowl of my shovel into the showcase window and reached between the jagged edges of glass to pull out shoes, a dozen pairs of boots and pumps and loafers, sweeping them into the puddles of the street. SA stormtroopers were kicking in the doors of homes and dragging the residents in their nightclothes into the center of town. They cowered in small knots, huddled over their children. Bonfazer was made to strip down to his underclothes and dance for the soldiers. "Kann ich's jetzt gehen?" the man begged, as he twirled in a circle. "Now may I go?" I do not know what made me do it, but I approached the man's family. His wife, maybe seeing my smooth cheeks and my young face, grabbed onto my boot. "Bitte, die sollen aufhören," she pleaded. "Please, make them stop." She was sobbing, tearing at my trousers, grabbing for my hand. I didn't want her snot on me, her saliva, her hot breath and those empty words falling into the cup of my palm. I did what came naturally. I kicked her away from me. As the Reichsführer SS had said at Wevelsburg that day, blood tells. It was not that I wanted to hurt this Jewish woman. I wasn't really thinking of her at all. I was protecting myself. In that instant, I realized what this night had been all about. Not violence, not riots, not public humiliation. These measures were a message, to let the Jews know they had no hold over us ethnic Germans, not economically, or socially, or politically. Not even after that assassination. It was nearly dawn by the time the convoy headed back to Wevelsburg. The boys dozed on each other's shoulders, their clothes glittering with the pixie dust of broken glass. Herr Sollenmark was snoring. Only Franz and I were awake. "Did you see him?" I asked. "Arthur?" Franz shook his head. "Maybe he's gone already. I hear a lot of them have left the country." Franz stared at Herr Sollenmark. His blonde hair fell over one eye as he shook his head. "I hate that man." "Shh," I warned. "I think he can hear through his paws. Erschlock. He probably hears through that, too." My brother smiled a little. "Are you nervous?" he asked. "About going away?" I was, but I would never admit that. It wasn't officer-like to be afraid. "I will be fine," I said, hoping I could convince myself, too. I shoved against him with my elbow. "Don't get into trouble while I'm gone." "Don't forget where you came from," Franz said. He talked like that sometimes, like he was a wizened old man in the body of an 18-year-old. "What's that supposed to mean?" Franz shrugged. "That you don't have to listen to what they say. Well, maybe that's not true. But you don't have to believe it." "The thing is, Franz, I do. If I could explain to him how I felt, maybe then he wouldn't stick out like such a sore thumb at the HJ meetings when I was not around. And God knows the less he stuck out, the less likely he was to be bullied. Tonight wasn't about hurting Jews. They were collateral damage. It was about keeping us safe. Us Germans. Power isn't doing something terrible to someone who's weaker than you, Rainer. It's having the strength to do something terrible and choosing not to." He turned to me. "Do you remember that mouse in our bedroom years ago?" "What?" Franz met my gaze. "You know, the one you killed," he said. "I forgive you." "I didn't ask for your forgiveness," I told him. My brother shrugged. "That doesn't mean you didn't want it." The first person I ever shot was running away from me. I was no longer working at a concentration camp. In August 1939, we had been mobilized from Sachsenhausen and sent to follow the German troops as part of the SS Totenkopfenstarter. It was now September 20th. I remember this, because it was Franz's birthday, and I did not have the time or the resources to write to him that day. We had crossed into Poland 7 days earlier, trailing behind the army. Our route was from Ostrowo, through Kalisz, Turek, Dzuki, Choszniewice, Kłodawa, Pszczedek, Włocławek, Dębica, Bydgoszcze, Wirzyc, Szarnekau, and finally, Chodzież. We were to annihilate any form of resistance we found. On that particular day, we were doing what we'd been dispatched to do, conducting house searches, rounding up insurgents, and arresting those who were suspicious, Jews, Poles, activists. Another soldier, Urprecht, a boy with a face like risen dough in a sensitive stomach, had accompanied me to this enclave of homes. It was a miserable rainy day. We did a lot of shouting. My voice was stripped raw from telling the stupid Poles, who did not understand my German, to get out and join the others. There was a mother, a girl of about 10, and a teenage boy. We were looking for the father, who was one of the leaders of the local Jewish community. But there was no one else in the house, or so Urbrecht said after canvassing it. I screamed in the face of the woman, asking her where her husband was. But she would not answer. As the rain drenched her, she fell to her knees and started sobbing and pointing back to the house. It was giving me a headache like no other. Nothing the son said could soothe her. I poked her in the back with my rifle, indicating where they should march. But the woman remained kneeling in the muddy puddle. As Urbrecht hauled her upright, the teenage boy started to run back to the house. Now, I had no idea what he was after. For all I knew, it was a weapon that Urbrecht had overlooked. I did what I had been told to do. I shot. The boy was running, and the next instant, he wasn't. The sound of the bullet was deafening, hollow. At first, I couldn't hear anything because of it. And then I did. The cries were soft and hitched together like train cars. I stepped over the broken body of the boy and walked into the kitchen. I have no idea how that idiot Urbrecht might have missed the baby who had been lying in the laundry basket, the one who was now wide awake and shrieking her head off. Say what you will about the inhumanity of the SSTV during the invasion of Poland, but I gave that woman her baby before we marched her off. We started with the synagogues. Our commander, Standartenführer Nostitz, explained the Judenaktion we would be undertaking in Wrocławek. It was much like what we had done with Herr Solenmark in Paderborn almost a year earlier, but on a bigger scale. We rounded up Jewish leaders and forced them to clean lavatories with their prayer shawls. We made them dig ditches in pools of water. Some of the soldiers beat the old men who couldn't work fast enough, or bayoneted them, and others took pictures. We made religious leaders shave off their beards and throw their holy books into the mud. We had dynamite, and we used it to blow up the synagogues and set them on fire. We broke the windows of Jewish shops and rounded up masses of Jews to be arrested. Leaders of the Jewish community were lined up in the street and executed. The scene was chaos, with glass raining through the air and burst pipes spilling water onto the street, horses rearing back from the carts they pulled, blood turning the cobblestones red. The Polish civilians cheered us on. They didn't want the Jews here any more than we Germans did. 2 days into the Aktion, the Standartenführer ordered 2 Sturmbanner within the battalion to splinter off and perform a special task. There were lists of names recorded by the SD and the police, names of intellectuals and resistance leaders in Poznan and Pomerania. We were to find and eliminate these people. It was an honor to be chosen, but it wasn't until we reached Bydgoszcz that I came to understand the scope of this exercise. The death list wasn't a sheet of names. It was 800 people. A tome. Jews, they were easy to find. They were Polish teachers, priests, leaders of nationalist organizations. Some were Jews, many were not. They were rounded up and gathered. A small group was singled out to dig a ditch. They believed it was an anti-tank trench they were creating. But then the first group of prisoners was led up to the ditch, and it was our job to shoot them. There were 6 of us trusted with this task. 3 would aim at the head, 3 at the heart. I picked the heart. Our shots rang out, and there was a fireworks display of blood, of brains. Then the next group of prisoners stepped up to the edge of the ditch. The ones at the end of the line, they saw what was happening. They must have understood as they turned toward us soldiers that they were facing their death. And yet for the most part, they did not run. They did not try to escape. I do not know if this meant they were very, very stupid, or very, very brave. One teenage boy stared at me as I lifted the rifle to my shoulder. He lifted his hand and pointed to himself. In perfect German, he said, 19. 19. After the first 50, I stopped looking at their faces. My fortitude in Poland got me sent to SS Jugendschule Bad Tölz, an officer's training school. Before shipping out, I was given 3 weeks' leave, and I went back home. Only a year had passed, but I was markedly different. When I left, I was still a child. Now I was a man. I had pulled a screaming baby out of the arms of its mother. I had killed boys and girls my own age, and much younger, too. I'd gotten used to taking what I wanted when I wanted it. Being in the home of my parents chafed. I felt too big for the space, too full of electricity. My brother, on the other hand, saw our little home in Wevelsburg as a haven. He was at the top of his class at gymnasium, expecting to head to university. He wanted to become a writer, still, and failing that, a professor. He did not seem to understand the simplest logistical fact. Germany was at war. Nothing was as it had been. Any childhood dreams we had had were long gone, sacrificed to the greater good of our country. Franz had received a document stating that he needed to report to recruitment headquarters, but he had thrown it into the fire. As if that might be enough to keep the SS from finding him and forcing him to do it. They don't need people like me, he had said at dinner. They need every able-bodied man, I had told him. My mother feared Franz being singled out as a political opponent of the Reich, instead of being recognized as indifferent. I did not blame her. I knew what happened to those who were political opponents of the Reich. They disappeared. The first day after I came home, I woke to find sunlight streaming through the windows, and my mother sitting on the edge of my narrow bed. Franz was already gone to gymnasium. I had slept till nearly noon. I drew the covers up to my chin. Is something the matter? My mother tilted her head. I used to watch you sleep when you were a newborn, she told me. Your father thought I was crazy. But I believe that if I turned away, you might forget to take the next breath. I'm not a baby anymore, I said. No, my mother agreed. You're not. But that doesn't mean I don't worry about you. She bit her lip. They are treating you well? How could I explain to my own mother the things I had done? The Jews whose doors I had kicked in, so that we could seize radios, appliances, valuables, and anything else that might help the war effort. The elderly rabbi I had beaten for staying out to pray after curfew. The men, women, and children we herded up in the middle of the night and killed. How could I explain I drank to drive away the images I had seen all day? That I would be so drunk that sometimes the morning after, my hangover would be so violent I couldn't stand. How I would sit on the edge of the pit with my legs dangling, my shoulder sore from the recoil of the gun between groups. I'd smoke a cigarette, and I'd wave the nose of the gun to direct the next line of victims so they knew where to lie down. Then I'd shoot. Precision wasn't necessary, although we learned to be economical. 2 bullets to the head was too much. The sheer force would almost tear it from the body. "What if you get hurt in Poland?" she asked. "I could get hurt in Germany," I reminded her. "I'm careful, Mother." She touched my arm. "I don't want any Hartmann blood spilled." I could tell from the look on her face that she was thinking about Franz. "He will be all right, too," I told her. "There are special forces groups headed by men with doctorates. There's room for scholars in the SS, too." This made my mother brighten. "Maybe you can tell that to him." She left, promising to make me a lunch fit for a king, since I had slept through breakfast. I showered and dressed in my civilian clothes, aware that even the way I carried myself now made me look like a soldier. By the time I was finished with the plate of food my mother had prepared for me, the house was quiet. My father was at work, my mother at her church volunteer group. Franz was in classes until 2 o'clock. I could have walked into town, but I didn't feel like being sociable. So instead I went back to the bedroom I had shared with my brother. On his desk was a small block of wood, roughly fashioned like a werewolf, lined up along the blotter were two more in various stages of precision. There were also a vampire, with its arms crossed and its head thrown back. In my absence, my little brother had become quite the craftsman. I picked up the vampire, and was testing the points of its sharp teeth against the ball of my thumb, when I heard Franz's voice. "What are you doing?" I whirled around to find him staring down at me. "Nothing." "That's mine," he snapped, grabbing the carving from my hand. "Since when did you take up whittling?" "Since I decided I wanted to make a chess set," Franz said. He turned away and began to search his bookshelves. Franz collected books the way some people collect coins or stamps. They overran his desk and his shelves. They were piled up beneath his bed. He never donated a book to a church rummage sale, because he said he never knew if he'd want to read it again. I watched him pull a stack of horror stories from the narrow space between his desk and the wall, and I scanned the titles. The Wolf of Crimea, Bloodlust, The Haunting. "Since when do you read that stuff?" I asked. "Why is it any of your business?" Franz emptied his book bag on the bed and replaced his school textbooks with the novels. "I'll be back later. I have to walk Otto, the Mueller's dog." It didn't surprise me to hear that Franz had taken on this odd job, just that the Mueller's dog was still alive after all this time. "Are you planning on reading to him too?" Franz didn't reply, just hurried out of the house again. Shrugging, I settled on my narrow mattress with one of his books and cracked the spine. I read the same sentence three times before I heard the front door close. And then I went to the window and watched my brother cross the street. He strode right past the Mueller's house. I walked downstairs and slipped outside, using my tactical military training to follow Franz for several minutes to a house I did not recognize. I didn't know the residence, but it looked as if nobody was home. The shutters were drawn, the house in a state of disrepair. Yet when Franz knocked, the door opened to admit him. I waited for about 15 minutes, hiding behind a hedge, until my brother reappeared, his book bag slack and empty against his hip. I stepped out from behind the shrubbery. "What are you up to, Franz?" He pushed past me. "I'm bringing books to a friend. As far as I know, that's not a crime." "Then why would you tell me you're walking a dog?" My brother didn't say a word, but two bright spots of color appeared on his cheeks. "Who lives here that you don't want me to know you're visiting?" I raised my brows, grinning, suddenly wondering if my little brother had become a ladies' man in my absence. "Is it a girl? Has something other than poetic meter finally got you twitching?" Playfully, I cuffed him on the shoulder, and he ducked away from me. "Stop it," he muttered. "Ah, poor Franz. If you'd asked me, I would have told you to bring her chocolates, not books." "It's not a girl," Franz blurted out. "It's Arthur Goldman. That's who lives here." It took me a moment to place the name. The Jew, from Franz's class at gymnasium. Most of the Jews in our town had left. I didn't know where they'd gone, to the big cities, maybe Berlin. I'd not given any thought to it, really, but obviously my brother had. "Jesus, is this why you won't join the SS? Because you're a Jew lover?" "Don't be an idiot. I'm not the idiot here, Franz," I said. "I'm not the one fraternizing with enemies of the Reich." "He's my friend. He misses school, so I bring him books. That's it." "You have a brother who is an SS officer candidate," I said quietly. "You will stop fraternizing with a Jew." "No," my brother replied. "No. No." I could not remember the last time someone had told me that. I grabbed him by the throat. "How do you imagine it will look when the Gestapo finds out? You could ruin my career for this, after all I've done to protect you." I released my hold on his neck, and he choked and jackknifed, coughing. "Be a man, Franz. For once in your miserable life, be a fucking man." He stumbled away from me. "Who the hell have you turned into, Rainer?" I fumbled a cigarette out of my pocket and lit it. took a drag. Perhaps I came on too strong, I admitted, softening my voice. Perhaps all you really need to hear from me is this. I blew a ring of smoke. Tell Arthur you can no longer visit him, or else I will make sure there is no one there for you to visit. The composure on my brother's face cracked. He turned to me with an expression I had seen so often this past year I'd grown cold to it. Please, Franz said. You wouldn't. If you really want to save your friend, I told him, then stay the hell away from him. 2 nights later, I was awakened by my brother's arm pressing hard on my windpipe. You lied, he hissed. You said you wouldn't do anything to Arthur. And you lied, I said, or you wouldn't have known that they left. It had not been difficult to sow the seeds of intolerance, to let the family know they were not welcome here. I didn't make them leave town, really. That was pure instinct, self-preservation on their part. I had done it because I knew I was strong where my brother was weak, that he would continue to visit Arthur, and here was the proof that I had been right to take action. If it was books today, tomorrow it would be food, money, shelter. That I could not let happen. I did you a favor, I gritted out. My brother released the pressure on my throat. In the moonlight I saw an expression on his face I had never seen before. His eyes were black and flat, his jaw wired with rage. He looked like he was capable in that instant of killing me. I knew then my mother could stop worrying. Even if Franz were dragged to the recruitment center, even if he never set foot in university and was shipped off like me to officer training, even if he had to fight on the front lines, he would be able to survive this war. We never spoke of Arthur Goldman again. In the months I spent at Junkerschule, I studied Mein Kampf. I played war strategy games in sandboxes, and I took endless exams, which weeded out one of every 3 cadets from the program. We had classes in tactics, terrain and map reading, combat training, current events, weapons training. We studied weapons technology, went to the shooting range, and learned about the administration of the SS and the police. We were taught how to maneuver a tank, how to survive in the wild, and how to fix a broken vehicle. We were groomed into soldiers who were above average in knowledge, determination, and endurance. I graduated in 1940 with a commission as a second lieutenant in the Waffen-SS, an Untersturmführer. I was posted to the government central in Poland until April 24, 1941, when the 1st SS Infantry Brigade was formed. We were a special Waffen-SS unit, part of the Kommandostab of the Reichsführer-SS, and we were deployed in shooting situations against civilians. As an Untersturmführer, I led one of the 15 companies that made up the 8th SS Infantry Regiment, which fell under the umbrella of the brigade. We moved through northern Ukraine, from Dubno to Rovno to Zhytomyr. What we did was just what I had done years earlier in Poland, except there were fewer Jewish leaders and political prisoners left. My supervisor, Hauptsturmführer Volker, had given us our orders. Round up all political undesirables, and all racial inferiors, gypsies, for example, and all Jews, men, women, and children. We were to collect their valuables and clothes, to march them to open fields and ravines on the outskirts of towns and cities that had been conquered, and to kill them. The Reinigungsaktion went as such. We would require the Jews to report at a given site, school or prison or factory, and then take them to a place that had been prearranged. Some of these places were natural ravines, some were dugouts built by the prisoners themselves. After they'd given up their clothing and valuables, we would drive them into the pit and make them lie face down. Then, as the commanding officer of the regiment, I would give the order. The NCOs and volunteers, Waffen-SS men, would lift their carabiner 98Ks and shoot the prisoners in the back of the neck. Then some soldiers would haul in a load of dirt or lime before the next group was driven into the pit. I would walk among the bodies, find the ones that were still moving, and deliver the coup de grace with my pistol. I did not think about what I was doing. How could I? To be stripped naked, shouted at to move faster and faster towards the pit with your children running beside you, to look down and see your friends and your relatives dying an instant before you, to take your place between the twitching limbs of the wounded and wait for your moment, to feel the blast of the bullet and then the heaviness of a stranger falling on top of you. To think like this was to think that we were killing other humans, and to us they could not be humans, because then what did that say about us? And so, after each action, we got drunk, so incredibly drunk that we drove from our nightmares that unholy image of the ground bleeding, the red runoff swelling like a geyser after all the bodies were in the pit. We drank until we could no longer smell the shit that coated the corpses, until we did not see, printed on the backs of our eyelids, the occasional child who clawed his way to the top of the tangle of limbs, shot but not dead, and ran around the pit bleating for his mother or father, until I put us out of our misery and killed him with a single bullet. Some of the officers went crazy. I feared I might too. There was another second lieutenant who had one of his men get up in the middle of the night, walk out of camp, and shoot himself in the head. The next day the second lieutenant refused, simply refused, to shoot anyone. Folkel had him transferred to the front lines. In July, Folkel told us there would be an action on the road between Rouvno and Jytomyr. 800 Jews had been rounded up. Although I had given the men explicit orders about how they were to conduct themselves and when to shoot, when the third group of prisoners stood naked at the edge of the pit, shaking and weeping, one of my enlisted men began to fall apart. Schultz put aside his rifle and sank to the ground. I ordered him to stand down and picked up his weapon. "What are you waiting for?" I barked at the soldiers who were responsible for bringing the next group of prisoners forward. This time, I was the first to fire my weapon. I would set the example. I did this for the next three sets of prisoners, and as blood and grey matter sprayed onto my uniform, I set my jaw and ignored it. As for Schultz, he would be posted behind the front. The SS did not want anyone on the front lines who might not be able to shoot. That night, my men went carousing at the local tavern. I sat outside under the stars and listened to the glorious silence. No crackerjack of bullet shots, no screams, no cries. I had a bottle of whiskey that was nearly empty after 2 hours of nursing it. I did not go into the tavern until my men left, staggering down the street and balanced precariously on each other like a child's wooden blocks. At this hour, I expected the tavern to be unoccupied. But instead, there were a half-dozen officers gathered, and in a corner, Folkel stood in front of one of the tables. Seated before him was Annika Belzer, the support staff who travelled with the Hauptsturmfuhrer. An executive secretary, she was much younger than either Folkel or his wife back home. She was also an abysmal typist. Everyone in the 8th SS Infantry Regiment knew exactly why she'd been hired, and why the Hauptsturmfuhrer needed secretarial support even when his unit was mobile. Annika had hair that was an unearthly platinum blonde, wore too much makeup, and was currently sobbing. As I watched, Folkel jammed the barrel of his handgun into her mouth. The others in the bar were not paying attention, or at least they were pretending not to, because you didn't mess with the leader of the infantry brigade. "Well then," Folkel said, cocking the trigger. "Can you make this come?" "What are you doing?" I blurted out. Folkel looked over his shoulder. "Ah, Hartmann. So you think just because you've got an enlisted man to listen to you, you can boss me around?" "You can't get it up, so you're going to shoot her?" He turned to me, his lips curling upward. "Why should you have all the fun?" It was different. A Jew was one thing. But this girl, she was German. If you pull that trigger, I said calmly, although my heart was hammering so loud I could feel it move the heavy wool of my uniform jacket, the Obersturmbannführer will hear about it. If the Obersturmbannführer hears about it, Folkel said, I will know who to blame, hmm? He removed the gun from Annika's mouth and smacked her across the cheek with it. She fell to her knees, then scrambled upright and ran out. Volkel strode toward a group of SS officers and began to drink shots with them. Suddenly I had a headache. I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to be in the Ukraine at all. I was 23. I wanted to be sitting at my mother's kitchen table, eating her homemade ham soup. I wanted to be watching pretty girls walk down the street in high heels. I wanted to kiss one of them in the brick alley behind the butcher. I wanted to be a young man, with his life ahead of him, not a soldier who walked through death every waking day and scraped its entrails from his uniform each night. I staggered out of the tavern and saw a flash of something bright from the corner of my eye. It was the secretary, her hair catching the light of a street lamp. "My knight in shining armor," she said, holding out a cigarette. I lit it for her. "Did he hurt you?" "No worse than usual," she said, shrugging. As if she'd conjured it, the doors of the tavern opened, and Folkel stepped into the cold. He gripped her chin and kissed her hard on the mouth. "Come, my dear," he said, smooth and charming. "You aren't going to be angry with me the whole night, are you?" "Never," she replied. "Just let me finish my cigarette." His glance flickered over me, and then he disappeared back into the tavern. "He's not a bad man," Annika insisted. "Then why do you let him treat you that way?" Annika looked me in the eye. "I could ask you the same," she said. The next day, it was as if our altercation had never happened. By the time we had arrived in Zviahel, we were no longer using rifles, but rather machine guns for our action. Soldiers funneled the Jews in an endless stream into the trenches. There were so many of them this time, 2,000. It took 2 days to kill them all. There was no point in spreading sand between the layers of the bodies. Instead, others in the regiment simply herded the Jews on top of their relatives and friends, some of whom were still in the throes of dying. I could hear them whispering against each other's necks, soothing, in the seconds before they were shot themselves. One of the last groups had a mother and a child. This was not extraordinary. I had seen thousands of them. But this mother, she carried the little girl and told her not to look, to keep her eyes closed. She placed her toddler between two fallen bodies as if she were tucking her in for the night. And then she began to sing. I didn't know the words, but I knew the melody. It was a lullaby that my mother had sung to my brother and me when we were little, albeit in a different language. The little girl sang too. "Nit verhalten," the Jewish sang. "Don't stop." I gave the command, and the machine guns chattered to life and shook the ground upon which I was standing. Only after the soldiers were finished did my ears stop ringing. That's when I heard the little girl, still singing. She was slick with blood, and her voice was not much more than a whisper, but the notes rose like soap bubbles. I walked through the pit and pointed my gun at her. Her face was still buried in her mother's shoulder, but when she sensed me looming over her, she looked up. I fired my weapon into her dead mother's body. Then the crack of a pistol shot rang out, and there was no more music. Beside me, Folkel holstered his gun. "Aim better," he said. I had spent 3 months with the 1st SS Infantry Brigade, haunted by my nightmares. I would sit down for breakfast and see the ghost of a dead man standing across the room. I would look at my laundered uniforms, spotless, and still see the places where blood had seeped into the wool. I've a drink at night so that I blacked out, because the space between wakefulness and sleep was the most dangerous one to tread. But even after the last Jew in Zviahl had been shot, even after Volkel commended us on a job well done, I could still hear that toddler singing. She was long gone, buried beneath countless layers of a townsfolk, yet the breeze would draw a violin bow across the branches of a tree, and I would again hear her lullaby. I would listen to the chime of coins being counted, and I would imagine her laughter. Her voice was caught in the shell of my ear, as if it were the ocean. I started drinking early that night, skipping dinner entirely. The tavern bar was swimming in front of me, untethered. I had to imagine each shot that passed through my lips rooting me to the stool upon which I was seated. I thought maybe I could just pass out right there on the gummy tables that were never wiped clean enough. I don't know how long I'd been sitting there. Then she showed up. Annika. When I opened my eyes, my cheek pressed against the wood of the table, she was sideways and staring at me. "Are you okay?" she asked, and I lifted my head, which was the size of the world, and watched her spin upright. "Looks like you need a hand getting home," she said. Then she was hauling me to my feet, although I didn't want to go. She was talking a million miles a minute and dragging me out of the bar to a place where I would be alone with my memories. I struggled against her, which wasn't hard, because she was a tiny thing, and I was considerably bigger. She immediately cringed, expecting to be hit. She thought I was like Volkel. That, if nothing else, broke through the haze of my head. "I don't want to go home," I said. I do not remember how we got to her quarters. There were stairs, and I was in no condition to navigate them. I have no idea whose idea it was to take off our clothes. I have no idea what happened, which, let me tell you, is a great regret for me. Here is what I do recall, with perfect clarity. Waking up to the cold kiss of a pistol against my forehead, and Volkel looming over me, telling me that my career as an officer was over.
"I have a surprise for you," Alex said when I wandered into the kitchen. "Sit down." I climbed onto a stool and watched the muscles in his back flex as he opened the door to the brick oven and pulled something from inside. "Close your eyes," he said. "Don't peek." "If it's a new recipe, then I certainly hope you've still made the rest of the usual order." "All right," Alex interrupted, so near that I could feel the heat of his skin close to mine. "You can look now." I opened my eyes. Alex was holding out his palm. In its center was a roll that looked just like the one my father used to make for me, and this alone made me feel like crying. I could already smell the cinnamon and the chocolate. "How did you know?" I asked. "The night I had to suture your neck. You talk a lot when you're three sheets to the wind." He grinned. "Promise me you'll eat the whole thing." I broke it open. Steam rose between us in the shape of a secret. The crumb inside was slightly pink, warm, like flesh. "I promise," I said, and I took the first bite.
Sage. Can you blame the creationist who doesn't believe in evolution if he has been fed that alleged truth his whole life and swallowed it hook, line, and sinker? Maybe not. Can you blame the Nazi who was born into an anti-Semitic country and given an anti-Semitic education, who then grows up and slaughters 5,000 Jews? Yes. Yes, you can. The reason I am still sitting at Joseph's kitchen table is the same reason traffic slows after a car wreck. You want to see the damage. You can't let yourself pass without that mental snapshot. We are drawn to horror even as we recoil from it. Spread before me on the table are pictures, the photo he showed me days ago of himself as a soldier in a camp, and the photo clipped from the newspaper taken on Kristallnacht, with Joseph, Reiner, grinning and eating his mother's homemade cake. How could someone who murdered innocent people look so... so ordinary? I just don't understand how you did it, I say, into the silence. How you live a normal life and pretend none of this ever happened. It is amazing what you can make yourself believe when you have to, Joseph says. If you keep telling yourself you are a certain kind of person, eventually you will become that person. That's what the final solution was all about, really. First, I convinced myself that I was of a pure race, Aryan. That I deserved things others did not, simply by the accident of my birth. Think about that. That hubris, that arrogance. By comparison, convincing myself and others that Eyre was a good man, an honest man, a humble teacher, was easy. I don't know how you sleep at night, I reply. Who says that I do? Joseph answers. Surely you see now that I did horrible things, that I deserve to die. Yes, I reply bluntly. You do. But if I kill you, I'm no better than you were. Joseph considers this. The first time you make a decision like that, a decision which rubs against all your morals, is the hardest. The second time, though, is not so hard. And that makes you feel a fraction better about the first time, and so on. But you can keep dividing and dividing, and you'll never entirely get rid of the sourness in your stomach that you taste when you think back to the moment you could have said no. If you are trying to get me to help you die, you're doing a lousy job. Ah, yes, but there is a difference between what I did and what I am asking you to do. I want to die. I think of those poor Jews, stripped and humiliated, clinging to their children as they marched into a pit filled with bodies. Maybe they wanted to die too, at that moment. Better that than live in a world where this sort of hell could happen. I think of my grandmother, who, like Joseph, refused to speak of this for so long. Was it because she thought that if she didn't talk about it, she wouldn't have to relive it? Or was it because even a single word of memory was like opening Pandora's box and might let evil seep like poison into the world again? I think, too, of the monsters she wrote about in her story. Did they hide in the shadows from others, or from themselves? And I think of Leo. I wonder how he subjects himself to these sorts of stories willingly every day. Maybe it's not so much about catching the perpetrators after 65 years. Maybe it's just so that he knows someone is still listening for the sake of the victims. I force my attention back to Joseph. So what happened after Folkel caught you in bed with his girlfriend? He did not kill me, obviously, Joseph says. But he made sure I would not work within his regiment any more. He hesitates. At the time, I did not know if that was a blessing or a curse. He reaches for the photo he showed me, the one of himself in the camp, holding a pistol. Those who did not want to do their job in a shooting brigade were not punished or forced to do it. It was still their choice. They were just transferred instead. After the disciplinary hearing, I was sent to the Eastern Front, a Bewährungseinheit, a penal company. Now, I was a lieutenant under recall. I'd been demoted to sergeant and had to prove myself or lose my rank. Joseph unbuttons his shirt and shrugs his left arm from the sleeve. There is a small circular burn mark on the underarm, at the armpit. They gave me a Blutgruppe tattoo, applied to the members of the Waffen-SS. We were all supposed to have one, although it did not always work out that way. One small letter in black ink. If I needed a blood transfusion, or I was unconscious, or my Erkennungsmarker had gone missing, the doctor would know my blood type and could take care of me first. And, as it turned out, that saved my life. There's nothing there but a scar. That's because I cut it away with a Swiss Army knife when I moved to Canada. Too many people knew that SS had them. They were hunting down war criminals. I did what I had to do. So you were shot, I say. He nods. We had no food, and the weather was brutal, and the Red Army ambushed our platoon one night. I took a bullet meant for my commanding officer, lost a great deal of blood and almost died. The Reich, they saw it as an act of heroism. At the time, I had only been hoping for suicide. He shakes his head. It was enough, though, to redeem myself. I had irreparable nerve damage in my right arm. I would never hold a rifle steady again. But by now, in late 1942, they needed me somewhere else anyway. Somewhere not on the front line. And you did not have to hold a gun steady against an unarmed prisoner. Joseph looks up at me. I had previous experience in the concentration camps. It was where I started my SS career. So after 9 months in the hospital, I was sent back to one. This time as the Schutzhaftlagerführer of the women's camp. I was responsible for the prisoners whenever they were present. Anus Mundi, that is what the prisoners called the camp. I remember stepping off the transport and looking at those iron gates, the words twisted between the parallel lines of metal. Arbeit macht frei. Work will set you free. And then I heard someone call my name. Joseph looks up at me. It was my brother, Franz. After all that resistance to supporting the Reich, he was now a Hauptscharführer, a sergeant, working at the same camp in administrative duties. This Anus Mundi, I say, I've never heard of it. Joseph laughed. That was just a nickname. You speak some Latin, yes? It means asshole of the world. But you, he said, you probably know it as Auschwitz.
He could hear every beat of her heart. It was almost in time with her boots as she ran. She should have known better, he told himself. This was all her fault. When she rounded the corner, he hit her from behind. She landed hard on the stones as he reached for the neck of her dress, tearing it halfway down her body while he rolled her onto her back. One arm pressed against her collarbone was all he needed to keep her steady. She begged. They always did. But he didn't listen. Her heart was racing now, and it was driving him mad. The first bite was the most gratifying, like a blade cutting through clay. Her pulse fluttered like an aspen leaf in the hollow of her throat. The skin was soft. It took only a gentle tug to peel it back so that he could see the exposed muscle, the veins throbbing. He could hear the blood, too, rushing like a swollen river, and it made saliva pool in his mouth. With years of dexterity, he carved through the muscle, snapping sinew and tendon like bowstrings as he shredded the flesh, dissecting until the sweet copper blood burst from the artery onto his tongue. It dripped down his chin like the juice of a melon as she went limp beneath him as her skin shriveled. When his teeth struck her spine, he knew she was of no more use. Her head, connected only by a strip of ligament, rolled a short distance away. He wiped his mouth clean and wept.
Sage. even though Joseph has spoken so much of death that it darkens his lips like a berry stain, even though I cannot get the images out of my head of a little girl singing and a young man pointing to himself and reciting his age, what I find myself thinking about are the others. The ones Joseph hasn't told me about. The ones who didn't even leave a mark on his memory, which is infinitely more horrible. He was at Auschwitz, and so was my grandmother. Did she know him? Did they cross paths? Did he threaten her, beat her? Did she lie awake at night in her fetid bunk and redraw the monster in her story with features that matched his? I have not mentioned Joseph to my grandmother for good reason. She has spent over 6 decades keeping her memories bottled up. But as I leave Joseph's house, I cannot help but wonder if my grandmother is one of the ones he doesn't recall, and if he is one of the ones she has worked so hard to forget. The inequity there makes me sick to my stomach. It is pitch dark and raining when I leave Joseph's house, shaking beneath the responsibility of his confessions. What I want is someone I can run to, someone who will hold me tight and tell me that I'm going to be okay, someone who will hold my hand until I fall asleep tonight. My mother would have done that, but she's not here anymore. My grandmother might, but she would want to know what has upset me so deeply. So I drive to Adam's house, even though I have told him I don't want to see him, even though it is nighttime, the portion of the pie chart of his life that belongs to someone other than me. I park at the curb and look in the fishbowl window of the living room. There is a boy watching television, Jeopardy, and beyond the couch, a girl sits at the kitchen table reading. Buttery light spills over her shoulders like a cape. The kitchen sink faucet is running, and Adam's wife is washing dishes. While I watch, he appears with a fresh dish towel and takes a salad bowl from her soapy hands. He dries it, sets it on the counter, and then wraps his arms around Shannon from behind. The sky opens overhead, which is surely a metaphor and not just a low-pressure system. I start to run and make it to my car just as the night is cleaved by a violet streak of lightning. I peel away from the curb, from this happy family, and drive too fast to the divided highway. The puddles on the asphalt are vast and black. I think of Joseph's image, the ground welling up with blood, and I am so distracted that at first I do not see the doe fly from the woods at the edge of the road to leap in front of my car. I veer sharply, struggling to control the wheel, and hit the guardrail, smacking my head against the window. The car comes to a stop with a hiss. For a moment, I black out. When I open my eyes, my face is wet. I think I might be crying, but then I touch my cheek and my hand comes away bloody. For one horrible, heart-stopping moment, I relive my past. I look at the empty passenger seat, and then peer through the shattered window.